Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
I'll be very, very happy to introduce you to our guest today, and that is Dr. Stephen Davidson. And the topic today is sex, so I'm sure everyone is going to enjoy this topic, and I'm just going to give you a brief introduction of who Dr. Stephen is. So Stephen is a psychotherapist and sex therapist in private practice in Fort Lauderdale, probably pronounced that wrong, Florida. He sees clients at his office or online via teletherapy. His clients are individuals and couples from all walks of life who are seeking solutions to sexual problems. And also, fun fact, Stephen was also one of the first team members who created the Secular Therapy Project, which is incredibly amazing. And I think Dr. Ray told us before that now we have over 400 therapists registered, so that is completely mind-blowing and amazing. So thank you, Stephen, so much for being here. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, and thank you for that introduction. And just to clarify, I'm in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Thank you. Yeah, no, English is not my first language, as you can all obviously tell. So, I don't want to know what I did to that word. I do apologize. So, Stephen, how would you start discussing the topic of, you know, sexual integrity, which is obviously the title of the session, because I feel like it's a very, very broad topic and something that a lot of ex-religious people struggle with. Eric, I just cut you there. Sorry.
Yeah, I know what sexual is. I know what integrity is. I'm not too sure about what those two terms put together are, because this is the first time I've heard it.
Well, I kind of decided on this term about 10 years ago. Because I was working with couples and individuals, and there were certain issues that just kept coming up again and again, and often related to people's comfort with being themselves, telling their truth, talking openly and honestly with their partners. And so I began referring to this as sexual integrity. And it is broad, but quite simply, it just means being yourself. And that's one of the hardest things for us to do in sexual relationships, because we grow up in, certainly in American culture, with a lot of shame around sexuality. And from very early in life, we are being taught to compartmentalize our sexuality. And so by the time we reach adulthood, so many of us have disowned it. And we think of our sexuality only as some activity that we are engaging in late at night with the lights off. It's after dark. And there's so much more to sexuality that is an expression of our whole personality, who we are as an individual, how we relate to other people, how we love, how we want to be loved. And so my work with individuals and couples is to help them get a lot of clarity with that and to get more specific with it, because they have had a lifetime of repressing and denying or hiding who they are. And so that's why I call it sexual integrity. Integrity is sometimes misunderstood. People confuse it with things like being moralistic or being self-righteous, but it's not about that at all. It's just about being more honest and walking your talk, just being able to be yourself in the world and in your relationships with other people.
That sounds really scary for someone like me coming out of coming out of where I was told how bad it is, and I have to squash those thoughts way back down in the back of my brain and not even think about that stuff. It sounds very scary.
I think it is scary to most people. And it's a journey. It's not something that, you know, people come and in 5 sessions, 10 sessions, they are done and they're ready to go. It's for many people, it can be a lifetime journey. Mm. And I actually have individuals that I've been working with for multiple years who are just taking the next step and the next step toward, we can call it coming out. Yesterday was National Coming Out Day, by the way. But it's not just coming out for people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. It's coming out as poly. It's coming out as kinky. It's coming out as asexual, meaning I really don't want to be in sexual relationships at all. It's coming out as just knowing yourself on many different levels and who you are as a sexual person.
Mm. Yeah, I remember, so I'm bisexual and I'm also poly. And I always say that being bisexual has been the easiest thing, like coming out was a non-issue for me. But being poly is like, wow, it's just like, you know, every time you say it out loud and you share it with someone new, it's like such a negative backlash of people thinking that you're selfish or you don't love your partner or you're afraid of commitments, even if I'm in a long-term relationship with my partner, we just happen to be polyamorous. So I feel like it's definitely something that so many people are affected by, because I wasn't raised religious and it was still at the beginning uncomfortable to talk about sex. And obviously now with the whole poly thing, it's like every time I mention it outside my circle of friends, they always get like the look of like, what does that even mean? You know, this like young person with a crazy, like, I don't know, sexual deviations or however you want to call it.
Right. And many people don't know what poly is. When you try to explain it to them, then they project onto it a lot of things that it isn't. Or, you know, I've heard other therapists say when they refer someone to me and they tell me that John or Jane Doe identifies as poly, they'll say, well, you know, this is probably just a phase mm-hmm. that they're going through, or this is because the relationship that they're in is not good. And so this is what they're doing on the way to breaking up. So there's a lot of misinformation out there about sexuality in all the different flavors and context in which it exists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when, coming out of the Baptist religion, there was a lot of propaganda around the word poly, and it was we were always taught that it was those bad, evil Mormons that were poly.
Polyamorous.
Polyamorous. And polygamous. So that was always like just bad. And you know, I'm coming out of that slowly as I've come out of religion at the same time. I've had to sort of reshape my thinking. But that was like the very first thing that comes to my mind when I just hear the word poly, other than like plastics or something like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, when people go to see a therapist, there's an assumption that the average therapist out there has some training in human sexuality. And that's not the fact. And so just like we have a need for the Secular Therapy Project, there is also a need for people to identify sex therapists who really are certified and trained in human sexuality. Because when I first became a therapist, it was not my intention to specialize in sex. It just kind of evolved in that direction. I began getting cases that were related to sexual dysfunctions or sexual incompatibility or things that the APA would say, the American Psychiatric Association would identify as a paraphilia. And I was working in Nashville, Tennessee at that time, and there were not many other therapists who had training in sexology. There was only one other certified sex therapist in the city. And so that's what prompted me to develop this as a specialization and get more training, is because the average therapist out there is not required to take any courses in human sexuality, yet their license allows them to diagnose and treat sexual disorders. So there is misinformation, often by therapists with good intentions. But it wasn't until I became certified and then went on and got my doctorate in sexology that I really realized how much I did not know and how I was just winging it. And fortunately, I have always been someone who's very open-minded and tolerant and accepting and not quick to place labels on people. So I think being in this profession is a really good fit for me.
It sounds like if for a therapist who isn't necessarily trained or exposed, a lot of personal bias can kind of creep in too unconsciously. Is that correct? I'm assuming.
Well, absolutely. When therapists don't have formal education, their only resources are their own personal opinions or their own personal experiences. And, you know, sometimes you will happen upon a therapist that has done some of their own research or they've done some reading. They want to get more familiar with the subject. But many therapists are just not even comfortable talking about sex. They may identify as a marriage therapist or a relationship therapist, but they want to talk about communication or they want to talk about conflict resolution. And one of the things many of us were taught early in our careers is if you teach couples how to communicate, the sexual problems will work themselves out. And that's not true.
Mm. Yeah. I'm kind of like just thinking of my own relationship. My wife and I get along pretty darn well, but I still struggle to talk to her about sex. And yeah, it feels weird being kind of so vulnerable right here and right now, but it's, I feel that I'm not the only one. I assume that I'm not the only one feeling that way either, but you know, we have great communication, the two of us, but that's something that I still struggle with.
Yeah, that subject may still feel like it's a taboo. And that's true for many married couples. I see people sometimes who have been married 10, 20 years, and they've never talked to each other about their sexual relationship. And early on when I would work with couples, I wouldn't split them up. I would always see them together because I didn't want to be put in a situation where one is going to tell me a secret and then I've got to keep a secret from their partner.
Wow.
But I had a colleague who said, as a sex therapist, you've got to split them up because you're not getting the whole story. And there are so many things that they will tell you if they can also see you one-on-one that they are not telling each other. And I found that to be true. So when I begin working with a new couple, I will see them together in that first session. I will listen to how each of them identify the problem or the issue that they want to work on. And then I will split them up and I will see them each individually in the following two sessions. And it's there that I always get the meat of what's going on in the relationship, what the problem issues are, because they have been keeping secrets from each other for years. And these are not just secrets about affairs, extramarital affairs. These are secrets about whether or not she's orgasmic, secrets about what he really likes or dislikes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's secrets about childhood sexual abuse that they never shared with each other. And so over the years, there's an accumulation of shame and trauma and myth and disappointments that accumulate that are not getting talked about. And so in the therapy sessions, we are starting to peel some of that away to get to the integrity, to get to the truth, to get to the authenticity.
Mm-hmm. And how can you, I know this is a very complex question, but how do you do it? Because obviously if someone has lived all their lives being told that they can't talk about sex or that whatever kink they have is wrong, it's probably obviously not easy to not convince them, but like encourage them to open up to their partners and like communicate like what they want sexually. So how do you do it? Like, this is just my inner psychologist really, really curious about what is the way.
Yeah. Well, it's far more important for me to think about the questions I ask than the advice that I give. And so I just put the question out there and I see how they respond. And I notice the verbal response. I notice the nonverbal response. I notice the interaction between the couple when the question is asked. Some of the questions that are on the poll tonight are questions that I might ask in a therapy session with a client. And I might ask one partner to answer for the other. What do you think Amaya's answer would be if I were to ask her this? Mm. Which is a way to see how much do they really know each other.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense, yeah. Sorry, Eric, go on.
So what would be some of the symptoms of not, like in a relationship of not dealing with this, of continuing, having these desires, but feeling weird about talking about it? What would be some of the symptoms or what could potentially happen without dealing with it?
Eventually people stop having sex. They get
with
distracted. They stop having sex with each other. They may be having sex elsewhere, but often their sexual relationship with each other is suffering. They allow their lives to be distracted. Children are a great distraction. If they don't have children to be distracted by, then they buy a new house. And they remodel the house. They work long hours. I've got couples that have been coming in to see me and that I see online since COVID because they're spending a lot of time at home together. And they don't have the distractions that they once had. They're not getting up every morning and going separate directions. And so it is bringing to surface some of the issues in the relationship that they have not been dealing with thus far.
Mm-hmm. So for a couple that is struggling in this sense of not being able to open up to their partners about these topics, what sort of, obviously assuming they're not going to a therapist, what sort of advice could you give them? How would you, if someone is listening to us who is struggling with this, what would you tell them to improve their situation?
I move slowly initially because I don't want to scare anybody off. And I am pretty comfortable talking about sex and asking questions about sex. And I've realized that I'm the most comfortable person in the room with the subject. Mm-hmm. And so I have to be cautious in how I bring it up. And, it's like sticking your toe in the water and you're testing the temperature. And if that feels tolerable, then maybe I'll go in a little further and then I'll go in a little further to see how far I can move to allow this couple to talk to each other. I also don't want to set people up to share information with their partner that they're not yet ready to share. And I talk about truth tolerance. I want to know if this is a couple that really can tolerate honesty, because sometimes there's lots of things going on individually that are being ignored or being denied that no one's talking about. Are they talking about it because they don't, are they not talking about it because they don't know it? Or are they not talking about it because it just feels too unsafe to acknowledge the elephant in the room? So sometimes I just have to let the elephant sit in the corner and kind of gradually introduce the elephant into the conversation. Hopefully when the timing is right and when I know that people are ready to move forward with really doing some serious work. And this is vulnerable stuff to do. Our sexuality to be open, to be honest, to be vulnerable in that way. That's probably the most vulnerable we can be with another person, because it involves our body, it involves our heart, it lets people see aspects of our vulnerabilities and our insecurities. And so I move cautiously mm-hmm. with couples to begin to broach these subjects.
Mm-hmm. What about for people who are in a relationship in which the other person isn't ready to speak about these things, but they are? So in the sense that there is an imbalance. So one of them is like really wanting to discuss it to improve their sex lives, and the other person is maybe just uninterested, but also maybe traumatized, or I don't know, like they just don't feel comfortable sharing their sexual fantasies or, you know, whatever the issue may be in that relationship.
Right. That actually occurs quite often. I have people who call and say, you know, my relationship is really in trouble. I've talked to my partner and she won't come to the therapy sessions. He won't come to the therapy sessions. Do you think I can make our relationship better if I come by myself? And if we're going to be doing sexual relationship work, then I need everybody who's part of that relationship to be present. And so I give them the option. I say, you know, I'm happy to see you for one or two sessions, just for a consultation, and talk about some ways that you might be able to communicate with your partner why this is important to you. And, you know, then go from there. We'll see if that makes a difference. But that is a big red flag and warning sign in a relationship when you've got one person who says, I'm not going to work on this, because basically what they're saying is, I'm not going to let this get any better. And maybe they're not going to let it get better because they are fine with the status quo. Maybe they're not going to let it get better because they really don't want to have an intimate sexual relationship with their partner.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Yeah. Let's think it the other way around. So it's on who their partner wants to, let's imagine my boyfriend wants to speak about sex and then I don't want to. What advice could you give to the person that doesn't want to speak about sex? Because obviously it's very difficult to be in both sides. It may be out of uninterest, as you said, but it could also be, other reasons, maybe a very strict religious upbringing or, you know, whatever it may be. So do you have any advice for people to be comfortable in their own sexualities? Because I know in previous RFRX sessions we had, especially with Priya, who is another speaker, she talks a lot about like individuals being comfortable with their own sexual beings before being ready to share it with someone else. I was wondering if you have any advice in that sort of aspect.
Well, yes, if they are contacting me, just the fact that they've reached out to me, that they've contacted me, is a pretty good indicator that they are ready to do some work. And so sometimes I say, well, can I call your partner and invite them in? Would your partner be willing to come in for a session just by themselves to talk about why they don't want to talk about sex in the relationship, or why they don't want to work on therapy? Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes I've worked with men with erectile dysfunction, for example, and their wife, their girlfriend is very frustrated. She's very angry. Maybe this has been a problem for a long time. And she says to him, it's your problem. You go deal with it. And so I will, with his permission, I will contact her and say, you know, in working with him, something I really need is your input. I need you to partner with me on this. I need to hear how long this has been frustrating for you. I need to hear what are the things that you've tried. And so often then that partner wants to get involved because they begin to see that there is some advantage for them to be involved. I talked about the questions that I ask and just kind of feeling out the climate of the couple and their willingness. And so people are more comfortable talking about things like intimacy romance. They like to use those code words for sex. And so if I have a couple that's doing that and I discover they're just not comfortable with the sexual language, then I'll speak in code and I'll say, tell me about an aspect of your relationship that was the most intimate memory that you have and what you liked about that. What about that felt intimate to you? Mm-hmm. So that they begin to understand that there is some advantage for my participation in this. It's ultimately going to improve my relationship.
Mm-hmm. And what about those people who don't have access to a therapist? Do you have any sort of advice you can give them, you know, from here without having to obviously contact you or someone else who may be in their area, you know, people who maybe can't afford therapy or, I don't know, they're just not ready to take that step yet, I guess. Do you have any advice that of things they can do on their own without having to go to a therapy session?
Yes, you can certainly do reading on your own. The American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists is a good resource here for evidence-based information around sexuality. The therapists and counselors that are certified through that organization are good resources to contact. Also, there are educators in that organization that can provide educational materials. You know, Google, I think, is wonderful. Get on Amazon.com, look for books. But it's really important to look at the credentials of the person who wrote that book. And are they actually certified as a sex therapist? Are they actually trained and educated as a sexologist? Because anybody can write a book about sex from any perspective or mindset. It's important to get those books that are written by people who really are experts in the field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, because I've heard that in America, I mean, not exclusively in America, but for some reason I associate it with America, that there is these like religious marriage counselors who also write books about sex, but they're like very Bible-based. So I would assume they aren't necessarily the greatest if you want to improve your sex life. Correct me if I'm wrong. They may have great ideas, but for some reason that I don't think so. Not sure.
I don't think they have great ideas. Yeah. Generally, you know, I advertise on my website because sometimes I've had people contact me and they want to know if I do Christian sex therapy. And I'm not really sure what that is. But the answer to that is no, I don't. And so on my website, I say that I don't work from a religious or faith-based perspective. I work from a science model. If you're concerns, if your issues are related to religion in any way, I'm not the person to talk to about that. Now, I have many clients who are parts of different faith denominations and have that in their background. But generally, when they're coming to see me, that's not really relevant because people who want to have good, fulfilling sexual experiences, I'll give you an example. I had one couple one time and they were swingers and they had swinging parties on Saturday night, but they had to end promptly at 10 because she was a Sunday school teacher and she had to be at church at a certain time in the morning to teach her Sunday school class. So people can straddle the fence. They can walk one leg in one world and another leg in another world. And if that works for them, then that's absolutely fine. But most of the people that I see are coming to me because they really want the expertise of a sexologist, and not because they are they're wanting a religious perspective on sex.
Mm-hmm. You real
Which
quick,
speak- yeah, sorry,
tell okay. us to, tell us what a swinger is.
Well, a swinger is a couple who enjoy sexual experiences with either other individuals or couples. Okay. And they sometimes find each other through online forums. Some cities have swinger clubs And so maybe they are a member of a club where they can find other couples that they play with. And swingers, each couple is individual. They make up their own rules about how they're going to do it. And are we always going to play together? Or, you know, maybe sometimes you'll play with them and I won't be there to play with them. I hope I answered your question about defining what a swinger is, yeah. Eric. But I also need you to just know that it's very broad. It's like people who say they are in open relationships. It's all up and down the spectrum. There are various degrees of that.
And is this a form of polyamory?
Some people might say that it's polyamory. I think of polyamory, polyamorous relationships of having more than one regular loving partner.
Oh, okay.
I think of that as being different from some of the casual sex that, or recreational sex that might happen at swinger parties or sex clubs. So the families that I've worked with who are polyamorous, they have consistent people who are involved, and they might live with them or they might not live with them. It could be just one other person that they are involved with, or it could be multiple people. But certainly polyamory is one kind of being open, but polyamorous families tend to have some guidelines and a structure around who their family is, who is contained in that unit.
Got it. You know, we hear a lot about folks becoming like addicted to sex, and it, you know, like for me on the other side, it still kind of scares me a little bit. But I hear a lot about like folks becoming addicted to sex. Is that something that you experience and can work with, or is even something to worry about or real?
Well, it is something that brings a lot of people into counseling. Many people call me or they show up and tell me that they are a sex addict. And that means different things to different people. It also gets referred to as sexual compulsion. I've heard it referred to as sexual impulse control disorder. It's been described as out of control sexual behavior. But it's mostly men who get identified as sex addicts. And my experience as a therapist is that it's generally married men who identify themselves as a sex addict. And the APA, the American Psychiatric Association, is who we look to establish diagnostic criteria for both addictions and sexual disorders. And you will not find sex addiction anywhere in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, except for one line that they added that sex addiction is not included because they really don't feel like there's conclusive evidence that people are addicted to sex. So that whole word of addiction is kind of tricky. You hear people talk about a shopping addiction and a food addiction. You won't find shopping addiction or food addiction in the DSM either. Certainly people shop compulsively, they overspend. Certainly people overeat, they may have eating disorders, but we don't think of that in terms of it being an addiction. And things like food and sex, the brain is hardwired to desire these things and to desire them often and to desire them in abundance. And the sex addiction paradigm would say, well, you know, when people have sex, it alters brain chemistry. It raises dopamine levels. It raises norepinephrine levels. It raises oxytocin levels. And so people are getting a high off of this. Well, yes, it does, but it should. We want it to. Yeah. Oxytocin is very important for facilitating bonding. And dopamine is important for giving us pleasure. And it is also the chemical that causes us to want to repeat things. That felt great. I want to do it again. Mm. And then I want to do it again. So given the evolutionary nature of sex and the fact that we get these internal reinforcements, positive reinforcements, we have to be really cautious about calling it an addiction, because we're supposed to like it. We're supposed to want it. And if we didn't, we would cease to exist as individuals and also as a species.
You mentioned sex addiction, shopping addiction and food addiction. And both of those, to me, seem like there is something deeper going on, and it manifests itself as wanting to get this rush of shopping or get this dopamine rush from eating food. Could sex be something similar to that? If you think you're addicted to it, there may be something deeper going on.
Absolutely. And it's one of the things that I love about studying sexuality is we can learn so much about the personality, about human motivations. And so when people come in and they tell me that they are a sex addict, and sometimes they haven't even diagnosed themselves, their wife has said, you're a sex addict. Their girlfriend has said, you're a sex addict. A friend has said it. And so I ask them to explain to me, what is it about your behavior that you think is out of control, is addictive? What are the consequences that you are having? And sometimes this is where we discover the secrets. Well, the consequences are that my wife found porn on my computer, or she found sexual images on my phone. And, there's been some infidelity. There are secrets that are being kept. There's deception. And so that then opens the door to, well, how much are you talking to your wife about sex? How much are the two of you communicating about this? What were your motivations for hiding this? What does that say about your trust in her, your trust that she know that you're looking at porn? Is that something that you have permission to do? And if not, why not? So it opens the Pandora's box to ask a lot of questions about what's happening in the relationship. It's another reason that I coach people toward this idea of integrity. Anything that you are hiding is something that you're likely hiding for a purpose. Maybe it's shame. Maybe it's you're afraid of hurting your partner. Maybe it's you're afraid your partner will leave. Or maybe you're afraid of rejection. And so if that's the case, then let's dig a little deeper and understand why this shame exists. And when was the first time in your life that you felt rejected because of who you are as a sexual being? So it opens the door to ask a lot of questions and to get people to really think about their sexuality and their life experiences in a way that maybe they hadn't really thought that much about them before.
So I imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you work with homosexual couples as well. Do you work with homosexual couples?
Yes, I do. I see gay couples and lesbian couples throughout my career. My caseload had mostly been heterosexuals, and individually it's mostly been heterosexual men, but I do work with a lot of gay men and some lesbians.
I'm not homosexual myself, and so I couldn't really put myself in that person's shoes, but one of the things that I'm imagining is that a person who may discover they're homosexual and is also coming out of religion might have like this double load of guilt or shame for what they were brought in, how their religious background has kind of taught them to be ashamed of sexual thoughts, then also that homosexuality is a horrible thing. Is there anything different or any different kind of struggles that folks who discover they're homosexual and coming out of religion, anything different that you've seen and you need to work with them about?
Well, I think people who are lesbian or gay, bisexual, trans, have grown up in a society that has demonized them. By the time they are adults, they have learned that religion is not their friend, that religion is part of the problem in their life. They are not going to be able to be supported by the church. You know, it's only been in the last few years that we've seen churches increasing their outreach to LGBT people. And many churches that are now performing same-sex weddings had the opportunity to do that before the Supreme Court decision. And they use that as an excuse not to. They use that as an excuse to not condone same-sex relationships. So I think gay people are more likely to be able to move out of their religion or discard their religion or alter their religion very early in life than heterosexual people, because you know that you cannot change who you are as a sexual being. And to be in integrity, you can't keep going to that church that's going to condemn you and shame you. So I think that people who are same-sex attracted do have it a little easier coming out of religion also than people who are heterosexual.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Yeah. Thank you. I feel very privileged that I feel like I was born into a family that was very accepting of the LGBTQ plus community. So I'm always so humbled when people share their stories where they haven't been brought up in those families. And my heart goes out to anyone who is listening to us who has had that sort of experience, because I can't imagine how painful that must be like and how much it must affect your life after. So thank you for being here, and I hope it all gets better.
So what would how would sexual integrity come into this whole discussion we had previously about the sexual addictions at all? How would we tie those two together?
Well, a sexual addiction model is about shutting down and repressing aspects of your sexuality, pushing it back further in the closet. And the thing with sex addiction is it's a really big bucket. You know, everything gets thrown in there. Affairs, pornography, masturbation, even homosexuality gets thrown in that bucket, as well as any of the paraphilias that are listed in the DSM. All that gets thrown into it, and it all gets treated the same with this model of just say no. And it doesn't work. If you really follow that model, people have a high relapse rate. And then every time they relapse, it reinforces their shame, the sense of failure that I'm already abnormal, there's something wrong with me. And every time I try to stop it, I'm not able to refrain from it. I keep finding myself drawn back to it. So I coach people to really understand what it is that they are drawn to. There's some reason that they're drawn to it. What's the consequence of it? How problematic is it? Most of the things that turn us on or that we desire sexually or that bring us sexual pleasure are not illegal and they're not harmful to anyone. And so why are you abstaining from this when no one is hurting from it and you really enjoy it? And it might be because, well, my mother wouldn't like it, or I wouldn't want my mother to know. Or it might be because, you know, in my relationship with my spouse, I agreed that I wouldn't do this. Well, maybe you need to recontract with that spouse around your sexual behavior and how you express yourself sexually. And those relationships that can tolerate change, because our sexuality changes over our lifespan of the couple. The couple has to be able to tolerate change also in order to stay sexually engaged with each other, to continue to be emotionally intimate with each other. It brings me back to that concept of truth tolerance. If you are trying to abstain from a sexual behavior because other people in your life don't like it, do you really need to be in those relationships? can those relationships be changed in a way that they are healthier for both of you? Because it's difficult for us to pretend that we don't like what we like. You know, there are things that we like sexually and they generally don't go away. What we like in our life, we're probably going to like throughout our life. So that's where integrity is important, is getting people, instead of denying and shutting down and repressing, let's step a little deeper into it. Let's lean into it and see what it has to offer you. Psychologically, how is this fulfilling for you? What are you getting from it that you're not getting from just vanilla vaginal intercourse?
Mm-hmm. So for those who have maybe more like unusual kinks, or even kinks that are usual but just not accepted like socially, and maybe they're in a relationship in which their partner doesn't accept that kink, do you have any sort of advice to give to them in order to A, accept their own kinks, because obviously there's no shame in having any specific sexual desires, and also in how to approach it in the relationship? Because obviously, I don't know, you may not want to just break it off the first time, you know, someone says that's weird, but you know, I guess there has to be a point in which you have to say, okay, well, this relationship isn't doing it for me anymore. So yeah, I feel like there were like three questions in the same one.
Yeah. Well, that's why the honesty is so important and the integrity in the relationship is so important. If it begins from a place of permission to tell the truth, then you can share with your partner what that kink is, what you enjoy, and how you enjoy it. And by doing that, your partner may come to understand it and know, well, this isn't something that I want to participate in with you, but I'm okay with you participating in this with other people. And some of those kinks, some of the fetishes, are really best enjoyed outside of an intimate monogamous relationship. Sometimes people don't want that to be part of their relationship with their primary partner. They really do want it to be something that they can compartmentalize, because it might not be an exclusive fetish for them, meaning that they are able to enjoy sexuality in a lot of other ways with their partner. And this is just one more aspect of who they are as a sexual being that they might be able to address in another way. And for some people, that's just by looking at images of it, pictures, videos. For some people, that enough is satisfying of that fetish or that kinky behavior.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, that makes sense. I feel like I've run out of questions to ask.
So I've been corrected by the chat, and I really appreciate it. I understand that before I had used a pejorative term, and so going forward, when I when we speak about same-sex couples, we'll just use the term gay instead of what I had used previously. So thank you, chat, for correcting me on this. So we've talked about what the harm can get done with when we don't talk about when we don't talk to our partner about what we like, and kind of talk and what the benefits are when we can seek some therapy or seek some other resources where we can sort of work on this together. We talked about kinks a little bit, but is there anything more that you want to speak with us about on, the real meaning of sexual integrity or intimacy, and kind of how we can find that or understand that more?
Well, intimacy is a very vulnerable experience to have with another person. And sometimes we have intimate experiences, emotional intimacy, with people that we don't have sexual relationships with. Sex, love, intimacy, those are three different concepts. They are not synonyms. They don't mean the same thing. And I do try to talk to couples about how to use the language, because they may call it intimacy, but they're having sexual experiences that are anything but intimate. And a lot of sexual behavior that happens around the world doesn't happen in a loving, committed relationship. And so getting people to really name what they're doing with language that's more descriptive, I think is important. And helping people understand that intimacy means that I really can tolerate your truth. I want you to be honest with me. It's safe for you to be honest with me. I'm going to listen. And even if I don't understand, I'm going to try to understand. I'm going to validate you. I want to know you better. That is intimacy. It is wanting to know someone on a deeper level. And many relationships that, they're monogamous, but they're not really intimate because they're not being completely honest. And there's fear of telling the other person who I really am.
Yeah, that is that's something that I struggle with. And I talked about that earlier too, in my own relationship. Like my wife is just one amazing woman and just created a super safe environment, but there's still stuff that I struggle to talk about. And I can talk to her about just about anything.
Yeah, I don't want to put you on the spot, Eric, but what are you afraid of?
I don't really know. I think it's more shame that that some of these thoughts are there. I'm getting all the flop sweats, which is fun. I think it's just kind of shame, and maybe like there's someone watching that disapproves. Ooh, that's weird.
Yeah. And so if you were a client, I might ask you, where do you think that came from? Who watched early in your life and disapproved? Whose voice are you hearing in your head? I'm not asking you to answer that now, but that would be the kind of question I would ask of a client. Okay. Because, thank you for sharing that. But what you shared is very, very common. People are... we feel ashamed. We fear that we will be rejected. We fear that we will lose love or respect.
Yeah, or even just be rejected too. Like, you're weird. This is not normal. Those things. Even if it's totally normal, just coming from my own background, it was never something I was educated about. It was something that probably happened in the church that I was raised in, but nobody, everybody kind of had this unwritten rule about shaming it. And so it's just kind of what I took on, I guess, as a young kid and early and teenager.
Right. And so that's a good example of how people learn to keep secrets. They don't tell all the truth. They don't ask for everything they want. They don't share all of who they are as a sexual being because they are afraid of people thinking they're weird or abnormal or misunderstanding it. And so people live with a lot of secrets and denying things that they might really want to experience, or hiding things that they are experiencing, and then feeling a lot of guilt because they know they're not being transparent with their partner or their family. So it feels wonderful when you can let go of the guilt and you can let go of the shame and you can just live your life as a real person and be yourself and be loved and accepted for who you are. And that's so much what recovering from religion is about, is shedding that old stuff that didn't work for you or that was harmful for you.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I have experienced that relief, that lifting of the weight when I've dealt with some other things that I've been struggling with. And so, you know, that's something that I could kind of look forward to happening. I think what I'm kind of walking away from with this is like, it would be good to go through the resources we're going to list out and then possibly even find sexologists like yourself because I'm the one with the problem. It's on my end and not her end. So I should probably be the one to kind of work on it. Where would I go to this American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists to kind of find one near me and where I live?
Yeah. Yeah. There is a directory on that website, and you can just look in your state and find someone who is close by. And, if they're not close by, then you can meet with them virtually. Even before COVID-19, I was seeing a lot of people virtually because it's just easier. And I'm licensed in a couple of states and I have clients in other states. So it was just easier for me to be seeing people virtually. And now I see a lot more this way.
But you're not able to meet people over state lines, just basically in the state of Florida itself. And is that how most therapists are?
Well, I'm licensed in Florida and I'm also licensed in Tennessee. So the bulk of my clients are in those two states. Being in South Florida, there are people who have homes here and they have homes in other places. And so there are clients that I started working with here in the office, but, you know, they're going to be going to their other home or they may travel with work. And sometimes they're in other states when we have their sessions. I also do coaching, which is really more about teaching. It's not always psychotherapy. And so coaching isn't something that you have to be licensed for in any state. But the bulk of my clients are in Florida and Tennessee. Those are the states that I'm licensed in.
Perfect.
Sounds good. Is there anything else you want to cover before we jump to the Q&A section?
I don't think so. Let's jump in. I'm curious what questions people have.
I've got to cool off. I'm sweating a little over here. So why don't you start off and I can get something to drink?
All right. So one of the first questions that we received was, what if your significant other is wanting an open poly relationship without realizing it? Which I'm not sure what is the specific context of this, but maybe you can give some general advice.
What if your significant other is wanting an open relationship without realizing it?
Yes, correct.
Well, if you think that that's hanging out there in your partner's mind, but they are not voicing it, I would recommend just asking the question. I've been wondering, and I'm seeing these signs that make me wonder if you are interested in an open relationship. And so go ahead and broach that topic. I encourage couples to talk about all kinds of topics related to sex, even if it's not something that they're going to be participating in. Mm-hmm. It's just a way of getting to know your partner better and knowing how your partner thinks about it.
Yeah, sounds great. I wish we have gotten a bit more context of the question, but sorry, I feel like maybe we missed it. So someone else was asking about the females that go into your therapy, because you've spoken a lot about what your male clients get out of it. So someone was wondering, where is the question? Yeah. Do women walk away from your work with a deeper understanding of themselves as well? You know, is there anything specific that maybe you cover with females that you don't cover as much with males? Is there, you know, can you walk us through a bit what the females get out of the therapy sessions?
Yeah. Most of my clients are males, and I do have female clients. When I see females, I'm usually seeing them because I'm working with her boyfriend or her husband. And so I'm seeing them in a relationship counseling session. And women in our society are even more shamed about their sexuality and live in even a smaller box than men do. Men have more permission to talk about sex. We are expected to be sexual animals and to think about sex a lot. And so often women feel afraid to talk about sex, to express their desires. They fear being slut-shamed. They fear that their integrity will be questioned, their character will be questioned. And so, you know, in the relationship counseling, it's often the women who have more trouble talking about their sexual desires than men. And sometimes they will say, well, nobody's never has ever asked what my desires were. I don't even know what I desire. You know, men and women have sex for different motivations. And so I try to get them to talk about what her motivation is for sex. Some of the research that's been done on women and sexuality is that women often don't know when they are feeling sexually aroused physiologically. Mm-hmm. Men tend to know that. Men can identify it better. In studies that have been done with women, they are showing physiological arousal to visual images of sex. But when you ask, they say, no, I didn't feel sexually aroused. And that's been looked at as an example of how women are even more shut down sexually than men and have not had permission to really think of themselves as sexual beings or to claim their sexuality.
Mm-hmm. And related to that question, how often does it happen that a woman walks into your therapy session and eventually they realize that they're not attracted to men? Is that something that is common? Maybe never happens all the time.
I've never had one who came into a therapy session and who realized that in the course of the session, or who realized it in the course of the therapy. I have had women who have known it, but maybe it was in therapy that it's the first time they ever shared it with another person. It's the first time they ever brought the subject up. And so that happens in therapy a lot, that with the therapist, people will share something that they've never, ever told another person. And they feel comfortable doing it with the sex therapist because they know, well, you're not going to run out of the room. You know, hopefully you have some understanding of this. And they feel comfortable doing it because it's not someone close to them. There's not the same risk associated with telling a friend. And so sometimes in sex therapy, people are working on discovery and they are testing out new ways that they identify themselves. And the therapist is a really safe person to do that with.
Another question. So we talked about, you had brought up ED, erectile dysfunction earlier. What is your experience with ED being solved through therapy versus medication? Do you have any thoughts off the top of your head about that?
Well, most of the men that I see who have erectile dysfunction, it is really performance anxiety based. And the medications that are prescribed for erectile dysfunction are prescribed to treat ED that is really more from a related to healthcare issues. It's more of a physiological problem. And things like Cialis, Levitra, Viagra, and in their generic forms, those are not psychotropic medications. They don't do anything to treat anxiety. And sometimes men come to me and they've tried those medications and they didn't work. And so that just makes them even more anxious. I took the pill that was supposed to fix this. And for me, it is so bad that even the pill didn't work. Mm. And so we really do work then around the issue of anxiety. and helping them learn some relaxation techniques. Also, I will bring their partner in, because when this has happened, sometimes the partner takes it personally. I referred to earlier women who would say, well, I'm not going to the therapy session. This is your problem. You fix it. And it's because they feel, they take it personally. They feel like maybe he's not attracted to me. Maybe he's having an affair. Maybe I'm not sexually exciting for him. And I've never had a case where it was any of that. I've never had a man come to me and say, you know, I have a problem with ED because I don't like my wife, or my wife doesn't turn me on. Never had that happen. If anything, he feels a lot of shame and embarrassment and frustration because he wants to have a good sexual experience with her and it's not happening.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess kind of connected to that, although not necessarily, but we've had a couple of questions about how to let go of the shame of sex, and especially in the context of purity culture. So one of the questions was, what sort of recommendations, what steps would you suggest for someone who is struggling with purity culture? And then someone else has a more specific question of them being someone who is in their late 30s, and they haven't had sex yet because their religion teaches them that they can't have sex outside marriage. And now they're facing with sexual frustration. So how can these people deal with this sort of environment, thoughts, and I guess internalized, attitude, behavior? I don't know how to explain it, but yeah.
Well, I think one thing to do to address the shame is to find your tribe, to find other people who are like you, who think like you, who believe like you, because then it feels a little more normal. Then you don't feel so alone in it. And so I encourage people to meet other people who are like them, to seek out opportunities through meetups or clubs, organizations. To do reading. Sometimes I can recommend books and say, you know, here's a good book that's about the subject that you're talking about. And if a book was written about it and people are buying it, then obviously there are a lot of other people who think and feel like you do. And so that's a way of normalizing it. I have worked with people who have tremendous sexual shame because of their religious background. And it's limiting, you know, with those people. Sometimes I've had to say to them, I don't agree with what you were taught in your religion. I really work from a science perspective, and I can tell you what the science says. I can tell you what we know about men and women in general around the world from research that's been done, but it gives very different results from what your religion is telling you. And this is that fork in the road where you've got to make a decision. Are you going to go deeper into your religion, or are you going to go deeper into just what you intuitively know brings you pleasure or you want? And what's sad about working with so many couples who have saved themselves for marriage for religious reasons is they have no foundation under which to understand who they are as a sexual being. And they are very idealistic about sex. They think, well, we just get in a relationship and we get married and everything is supposed to magically work. And that's where they discover that it's not working, because these are also people who don't talk about sex. They don't feel comfortable talking about it. And so they arrive in the relationship and they have no clue about what each other likes, wants, how to connect on a sexual level. They come in with a lot of myth, and they end up feeling very frustrated in their sexual relationships.
Thank you. I had talked earlier and kind of about how I experienced it as sort of shame. Have you experienced folks who, instead of the shame, they feel more threatened, afraid for their safety, if when they talk about this kind of stuff?
Well, I mean, I would wonder, what are you doing? Why exactly are you afraid for your safety?
Or maybe more threatened. Maybe that is sort of safety.
Well, sometimes there are reasons to be afraid. There are reasons to be threatened. If you are engaging in some aspects of kink or BDSM, I really encourage people, don't hook up with someone that you met on an app because you want to try something new. There are ways to experience this. There are legal sex clubs that exist around the country where you can get instruction and okay. where you can meet with the same people on a consistent basis. You can get to know people and form relationships with them. And so I do talk to people a lot about safety. Sometimes people are engaging in things that puts them at risk of a sexually transmitted disease, or maybe they are engaging in behavior that puts them at other risk. What I certainly see a lot here are in South Florida is the fusion of methamphetamines and sex, and people really pushing their limits because on meth, they have lost their ability to consent. They've lost their threshold for pain. So I spent a lot of time talking about safety around that and not putting yourself in situations that are going to compromise your health.
Got it. I think we have time for two more questions. I'm going to read this kind of how it was typed in. My husband opened up to me about his problem with masturbation. He wanted to know when he would stop because our religion teaches it's a detestable thing. How can I encourage him? I'd imagine encouraging him to continue to masturbate or to stop feeling like it's a problem?
Well, again, we know that masturbation is normal. Men do it. Women do it. Adolescents do it. You know, I've only had two people in my entire career of 30 years tell me that they didn't masturbate. And I think both of them were lying. So, again, around the issue of religion, any of the religions, except for maybe some of the pagan traditions, are not sex friendly. They don't have anything good to say about sex. They demonize sexuality. They pathologize sexuality. I think since this is the wife who's writing in, just let him know that you don't have a problem with it, that you know that it's normal, that you hope that he gets over his shame and guilt about it. The American Medical Association has said that those men who masturbate 3 to 4 times a week or who ejaculate 3 to 4 times a week have lower rates of prostate cancer, that it's good for prostate health. So our bodies were designed to be sexual bodies. And we have an internal awareness of when our sexual appetite is kicking in, just like we know when we feel hungry for food or when we feel thirsty. We know that also sexually. And so I encourage people to just listen to what your body is telling you. Why are you denying your body? You know, I've worked with men who have denied themselves masturbation for religious reasons. They begin to have a lot of nocturnal emissions, wet dreams. Some of them have infections because they are not ridding their body of semen on a regular basis like it's intended for us to do. So those are some just healthcare issues and facts that I will bring in on this subject. But, you know, religion is probably not going to support masturbation.
How surprising. Yeah. All right. Well, then we only have time for one more question, unfortunately. I didn't even use the plural, right? Sorry, it's very late here. My brain is clearly not working properly. So how can we explore kinks in a safe way? Or when one partner is comfortable with exploring some things, but not other things, how can there be a match between both partners?
Yeah. Well, there's not always a match between both partners. And so the first thing I would say is give permission for one to enjoy something more than the other does. But talk about it. Talk about what you like about it. Because many people who engage in kinky behavior don't even want the genital stimulation from it. There is an erotic component to the kind of talk that you have in that scenario. There's an erotic component to what you're wearing. In being tied up, there is a dynamic of power and control that is feeling very erotic to that person. So get to understand all the aspects of what it is about that kink that is arousing for you. If it is something that is potentially dangerous, then you need a mentor. And that could be someone through a sex club. You know, in larger cities, you might find people who do this as a living. They teach sex education classes. They teach education classes around mummifying or around restraint. So taking one of those classes with your partner would be a great way to have some introduction to it. Doing some reading about it. I used to teach consent classes and talk about how to say no and what no means and how to ask for what you want and how to get a more clarity about what you want and what you don't want. And that's very important in kinky scenarios, that you clarify, here's the language I want you to use. Here's what you can say and what you can't say. Here's how I want you to dress. Here's where I want this to happen. And many people will spend a lot of time kind of choreographing their scene, their experience. And that's very important, and negotiating it with the other person that's involved. And so I hope that answers that question. But again, just having the good communication about it.
Yeah, it definitely does. Thank you. Thank you so much. All right. Well, then that is all we have time for today. Thank you so much, Steven, for being here. It's been such a pleasure. I feel like sex is one of those topics that we have had more sessions about, but it never gets old. Like, there's always new questions and new areas of sexuality to cover. So we really, really appreciate having you here. And it's been amazing. Really, really great. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the invitation. I think you posted my links, but you can find me at drstevendavidson.com. That's my website, and it's Steven, S-T-E-V-E-N. And then also on Facebook, you can find me under the Sexual Integrity Coach on Facebook.
Sounds great. Thank you so much. Eric, is there anything you want to say before we jump to announcing next week?
No. I'm going to go ahead and get the resources and the links into the chat. So, Amaya, take it away. Steven, thank you so, so much for coming on. And I just wanted to echo what Amaya said.
I enjoyed it.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.